It's Saturday, June 12th, 10:06 a.m. on the Central Coast of California. Today on Geek Speak, Geek News, in the second half, we'll be chatting with Mark Frauenfelder. He's the editor of Make Magazine and the founder of BoingBoing.net, all about the do-it-yourself revolution and his book on the subject, Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in the Throwaway World. In the first half, we'll be doing Geek News. It's time now for Geek Speak.
The bandwidth for GeekSpeak.org is provided by GNI, GNIHosting.com.
So you're living in a world that you don't know nothing about. Sitting at your keyboard paralyzed with doubt. But just sit tight, we're here to help you out. We don't know it all, but we'll tell you what we found out. If it's all Greek to you, then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Welcome to Geek Speak, bridging the gap between geeks and the rest of humanity. I'm your host, Lyle Troxell. Please keep in mind the views expressed on Geek Speak are not necessarily those of KUSP. Today's theme song is by Michael Saunders. He, as long as well as you, can go ahead and make music anytime you'd like and send us a theme song. We'll play it on air.
Then let us speak geek to you. We're here each week for you on your radio.
Geek Speak on KSP is supported by Whole Foods Markets, featuring products without artificial colors, preservatives, flavors, or partially hydrogenated fats. Whole Foods Market in Santa Cruz, Capitola, and in Monterey, and the Del Mar Shopping Center. Geek Speak is Creative Commons licensed, which means you can use it and share it and rebroadcast it. Whatever you'd like to do, let us know if you do. And of course, if you'd like to participate by giving us music like Michael's here has done, or images for the website, please feel free to do so, as long as your work is also Creative Commons.
Al's your basic new media architect. But you're going to have to tune in every week to know just what that means.
Sorry, I had to keep that part of the song. I love that. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me are, of course, Al Luckow. He's a new media architect. Morning, Al.
Hello, everybody.
And Miles Elam. And Miles Elam is a slacker.
Mm-hmm. And political junkie.
Political junkie.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here. We're going to be talking with Mark Frauenfelder in the second half, all about Made by Hand, the do-it-yourself revolution. We'll be doing that via Skype. We're not going to be taking calls today, but we are definitely going to be doing news the first half. And Al, I'd like to start with you and what's going on the iPhone.
Well, of course, everybody's expecting me to say, hey, did you see the new iPhone?
But you're not going to do that?
I'm not going to do that.
Okay.
Wait, who hasn't seen it?
That's exactly the point. Although it is pretty cool, but what I wanted to bring up was this... sort of another success story. This young girl, 22-year-old singer from, I guess she's in Korea. Her name is Kim Yo-hee, and she created a YouTube video using a number of iPhones or iTouches, mm-hmm. and she got tens of thousands of views, and she's doing like Lady Gaga songs using different applications on the phone. So she's like playing the multiple devices and singing at the same time. And apparently it's really caught on to the point where now she's getting her own record deal. She's signed on to Dream High Ent, based in Seoul, and will be releasing an album of her own music. But it's interesting, you know, she's just a YouTube, you know, just somebody who just went out and, we're going to do this thing and, uh-huh. you know, did it. And just an example of how, you know, just viewership on YouTube is just making stars of some certain people when mm-hmm. you can come out with some unique idea.
Did you watch her video? Do you like it?
Yes. I'm not a big Lady Gaga fan. Uh-huh. I like a couple of her songs maybe. But, and, you know, it's all played on. I like the idea that she's playing it on all these iTouches and iPhones, and yeah. she's got them like bracketed on. They look like a keyboard, you know, so, and she's got a nice voice and she's kind of pretty, so I can see how she really gathered a lot of attention from doing this, but
cool.
it's worth a watch, actually.
Right.
We'll post that on our links page.
On geekspeak.org, today's mm-hmm. show page. Hi, Miles.
Hi. we always think of the space race as being the U.S. versus the former Soviet Union, right, things like that. But it turns out we have a lot more players these days. A lot more nations in the world, many more nations in the world are...
And even private sector.
Space players. Mm-hmm. And the Japanese have done something very interesting, which is they've successfully deployed the first solar sail in space.
Oh, very cool. Hmm. To actually... to transport something?
To transport the ship, to actually provide propulsion. The sun provides a solar wind. The huge fusion reactions that are going on basically eject material from the sun. And what the solar sail will do is exactly what you do with a typical wind with a sailing ship, mm-hmm, in the ocean. It's like you try to angle it just the right way to get the most... effect, to have forward momentum,
and we've
also use it for power for photovoltaics.
Right. We know about the solar wind for a long time because, of course, comets, the reason why they have tails, it's the ejection material that's being pushed away from the comet, mm-hmm, as it's being vaporized by the sun and being blown by the solar wind. So we've known there's a force there for a long time. And, of course, it's not a lot of force. I mean, it's very minuscule.
Right. Which means that the spacecraft that has a solar sail has to be very not massive.
Right. Or wait a long time to move anywhere.
Right. Yeah. At the same time, this type of thing, it can definitely get you going, but it's not useful for general use outside the inner solar system.
Right.
Once you get out to places like Jupiter, Saturn, and beyond, the sun starts looking a lot more like any other star.
Right.
And you just don't have the output to get it moving. But if it were within the inner
around the inner solar system, it's great.
Right, or to get you started, yeah, to get that initial momentum to get you going.
And I'm assuming, like sailing, you can tact and do all these other things to not necessarily directly leave the sun, you know, go away from the sun. You can go and traverse
right
angles.
And that's something that I'm sure going to be trying out and trying new techniques for that, because it isn't... there isn't an atmosphere out there. It's
right.
It's a different environment that you have to kind of tweak
and,
with.
And
it.
The other thing about this solar wind is it's high-speed particles. It's not... I mean, I guess wind is kind of high-speed, but it's not very high speed, but it's a little different material.
Right. It's not an air medium.
Right. All right. Well, cool. Thanks for the update. I didn't know that we were that far along. I mean, as a species, not...
Pretty soon we're going to have space pirates out there.
As soon as you have solar wave,
yep.
That's the next
first
thing
that
happens,
is pirates.
It's true. Yep. It's true. Mm-hmm. Speaking of small forces, though,
I have one word for you. Hmm. Yocto-Newton.
That's small, I'm assuming. If I haven't heard of the the prefix, that means it's small. Well,
that
how small is
like
Yocto-Newton?
Really tiny. And the reason I bring up a Yocto-Newton, which is actually kind of fun to say, Yocto-Newton.
We have to start using Yocto and things.
It's the smallest unit in the standard model.
It
or
is
in the SI model.
In the name,
yeah,
model. So... that movie, I liked it. How much do you like a Yocto? You could,
yeah,
do that?
Yeah, and if you want to go the other way.
Okay, cool.
Oh,
thanks.
Wow.
Do you remember? Do you have
no,
all
not
memorized?
Yada Yocto. That's,
no,
that's
that would be in verse. It'd be zero, right?
Right.
What,
but
what
if you said
these?
Like a yottogram, that would be a lot of mass.
If you could give me a Yocto Newton here, I'm going to tell you about this. something I ran across in Science News. It's they have measured the smallest force ever measured. So,
okay.
A blob of cold beryllium ions is what they use to measure it, and the charged atoms registered the minuscule tug of an electric field to be 174 yocto-newtons, and that's about equal to the force of Earth's gravity on a 70-kilogram human divided by a million, then by a billion, and then by a billion again, and then by four.
Did you do that calculation? Was that narrative?
They figured that out.
So that would be the effect. How much you feel the Earth on your feet, if you will, the gravity, divided by a million, divided by a billion, divided by what?
It's
divided by four?
A 70-kilogram human divided by a million, then divided by a billion, then by a billion again, then by four.
That's really small.
Yeah, that sounds like the effect of the Earth's gravity on you if you were, let's say...
at a different star?
Well, not necessarily at a different star, but outside the solar system.
Yeah, wow, that's cool.
It was measured by NIST scientists. So they...
that's great. Yeah, I was wondering what the force was. It was electric force.
It's very, very
different. Okay, cool.
Very small.
I mean, I know that you probably don't know this, but I'm just curious. Do you know how many electron volts that was? At a certain distance, or
light reflecting off the ions changed the wavelength as the ions moved. This is the same. They use the same principle that cops use to determine, you know, how fast you're going with radar guns.
Sure.
Yeah, the telltale light change allowed the researchers to make the measurement.
Oh, interesting. So the force that was moved, or the particles being moved, I guess.
Right. Interesting. And the yocto means one part in a million billion billion.
Yeah.
Or 10 to the 24th.
Very cool. Thank you very much for that.
Here's a small story.
Tell us about the borders. Mom?
The borders have always been a curious place. That idea that U.S. concept of rights don't extend beyond the borders, you know, that only within our jurisdiction, but also that someone coming from overseas, for example, in this case for a case in South Korea, that when you're coming, that you don't really have protection when you're going through customs. You're not really in the U.S. yet, so Fourth Amendment doesn't really apply, at least to computers.
Okay.
What happened was a few years back...
I'm sorry, wait a second. So you're not a U.S. citizen. You're coming to the U.S. with a laptop. You're on U.S. soil in some sense, but you haven't actually gone through... You haven't actually gone through checkout.
On the contrary, this was a U.S. citizen.
Okay, interesting.
Coming back from South Korea.
All right.
Has a laptop. And someone decides, or the TSA basically says, you know what, I suspect there's some bad stuff on this laptop. We're going to confiscate it.
Mm.
But they haven't looked inside the laptop yet. So how would they know that per se? And then months later, they still hadn't searched it. They just confiscated it.
Huh.
So a district judge in Northern California... has said this doesn't really fly. This idea of you're confiscating it, having it locked up for months, and you might examine it for contraband without a warrant 6 months later, not so much.
Yeah, and that so just seems like theft. It's not like, I mean, the idea of confiscating it would be this is illegal or we want to search it.
Well, the idea behind the Fourth Amendment is we have probable cause, we're going right. to have this specifically and we're going to do it. This one is... Someone just happens to look around and go like, hey.
Yeah.
Laptop.
So where'd that laptop go? Someone's house. Mm. I mean, that's really interesting. So was this brought forth by somebody suing the TSA?
Suing the federal government. It's mm-hmm. the Justice Department who has been taking on the case.
Okay,
yeah.
Interesting. And so a judge said no, and they're going to change the policy.
The judge has contradicted it, so now, of course,
we'll see, most likely,
because it's been the Justice Department position that they should be able to do this, it's probably going to go to the appeals court, and it may go further than this. I find it highly unlikely that this is the end of the conversation, but this is where we stand right now.
Okay. Al, I like the idea of the smallest, that short news story. Do you have another small news story?
Another small news story?
Yeah, like the Star Trek one.
Oh, yeah. It's a sort of a mention.
Yeah.
It's the world's smallest Star Trek Enterprise ship. Two Japanese scientists have constructed a model of the USS Enterprise at 1/1,000,000th scale.
That's small.
Yeah, they did it. It's called, they dubbed it the Nano Trek. And, the only way you can see it is with an electron microscope. And it was constructed focusing an ion beam using, I'm going to see how I can do this, phenetherine gas. It's a process called chemical vapor deposition. Mm-hmm. The ship is 8.8 micrometers in length. And they have a picture of it on this website. And, you know, it looks like the Star Trek Enterprise. Even kind of has a shadow, which is weird. You know, when you see an electron microscope. It, the way that it reflects, it gives you this neat shadow. So I think it's I think every geek should go out there and see this thing. We'll have this link posted. It's kind of cool. It looks like the Enterprise, and it's very, very tiny.
Very cool. Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. Go ahead and mention the Skype thing, too.
Oh, Skype actually just recently came out with 5-way video chat. So that means that you can connect with up to 5 people using Skype, talk to them all simultaneously. I'm not sure. It's still in beta, and it's only for Windows. The beta that they allow you to download is only going to be for Windows. And the way it seems like they're putting it is that the multi-user video chat will be a premium service, so you'll probably have to pay for that. But it's kind of cool that, you know, you're seeing Skype do something now that, of course, iChat did this, 3 years ago?
Or, right.
But wait, up to 5? I thought iChat
five,
went up
iChat
to,
was 3.
Yeah.
Or four.
Well, they can do, yeah. But now they're going to do this 5-way, there's been some good things about it. There's a lot of bugs, but if you're the adventurous type, it might be fun to go to Skype and Skype.com and download their five-way beta chat client and try it out yeah. because it's going to be a service you're going to have to pay for. Like I said, you're going to have Windows. But it looks pretty interesting, and it might be fun, you know, connecting with people. I'd be interested to see what people thought of it.
Huh, yeah. I wonder if this is going to turn out like razors. We have five blades now.
Yeah. Yeah, the first blade pulls the hair, and then the second blade scores it, and the third blade cuts it, and then the fourth blade shaves off the first layer of your skin, and then the fifth blade gets down to your bone when you're... You know, it's like...
Remove all skin from
ridiculous. I think they should have stopped at three blades.
So the first person on the video chat can see that you haven't shaved, and the second one can see that...
One interesting thing about how they do this video mixing is that the server actually mixes all these videos together, so when you're downloading, you're actually downloading traditionally one video stream. You've seen that way of doing it, right, Miles? Is that pretty much how they'd have to do it with this many? If you have four video files coming down?
I'm actually wondering whether or not this is just a function of the amount of bandwidth. Over time, people get faster and faster average connections to the internet, and the more bandwidth that people have, the more you're going to have available for this type of thing.
Well, it's also a commitment on Skype's part because ultimately they're going to have to be the ones managing these streams, and so they're going to have to muck them together themselves. So the whole process takes place on, usually, I don't know for sure, but normally it would take place on the server of the application. So they'll be mixing it and then sending it to you. So they're absorbing bandwidth fees.
They're absorbing all the bandwidth fees and, of course, also processing time.
So there's going to be something there that they're going to be charging for.
Right.
But right now it's free. So go and check it out and talk to as many people as you can.
Good. Thanks for those two updates. Mm-hmm. Miles, tell us about Kanji.
Kanji is the pictographic language used in Japanese, also with roots in Chinese. So all those characters that you look at and say, or at least folks who don't speak Japanese, saying, hey, what is... I have no idea how to say that, because they have no representation to a phonetic alphabet, unlike hiragana and katakana.
Mm-hmm.
And it's estimated that, or rather, in Japan, you have to know a certain number to be considered literate. You have to. You had to know 1,962 characters.
1,000?
I'm sorry, 1,945 characters to be considered literate. To be able to say, like, yes, wow. I know how to read and write. And you have to be able to read and write them, but that you are, in fact, literate, that you are eligible to graduate from high school.
That's amazing.
Or the equivalent of high school. They're upping the number. In fact, they're upping the number by a non-trivial amount.
To how many?
To 2,136 characters, which isn't the highest it's ever been. It's actually been over 2,500 in the past. But 2,136 characters, and the reason being because of computers.
What does computers have to do with it?
Because before, everyone had to learn stroke order. You had to learn how to write the character, every single character.
Wow.
And nowadays, people are simply typing them into a computer.
Mm-hmm.
You are typing in, for example, the phonetics, the phonetic alphabet, and then the computer is interpolating it and making the character for you, which means that the burden for having to learn to write these characters has dramatically lessened. And so they're taking advantage of that and saying, okay, you need no more characters to be considered literate. We're raising the bar, as it were.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all because of the technology.
That's a whole new way of thinking about language, you know, as an image, as each word is, you know, the symbol.
On the contrary, it's a very old way.
Yeah,
I mean,
well, what I'm saying is it's really interesting because I actually been working with this startup, and I was designing a UI for this hospital in Japan. And it has to do with keeping track of a lot of people in a lot of different beds in a hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, you know, assigned, you know, the name of the hospital and all these different things to each column or each row. And they had requested, they'd come back and said, can you change that to a symbol instead? Just each person gets a, like one person's a flower and another person's, you know, a different kind of flower. And, you know, and so it's just a really weird request because mm-hmm. we're like, well, why not just name them the room numbers? No, can you just get rid of the number and give each person a symbol? And we're talking like, you know, it could be like 50 symbols for these people. And they'd rather think of the people as a symbol than a number.
I wonder if that's a
cultural thing, you know. And I just thought, wow, they really have this ability to remember.
So you just take numbers and kind of make them pretty. Like take a two and put a flower on top of it or something?
That's what I would be likely to do, but I don't know. It's just really to be able to recognize each thing by a symbol. Just
well, you know. Then when you think about having to recognize a symbol as a word or a concept as part of a word, it's not that far from how we read. In general, we don't read letter by letter.
Right.
We look at a whole word and see it as
a sight
word, character.
You know? Yeah,
that's Japan. Yeah. Basis. Simplified. Like, we don't think about it as, oh, it's sounding it out. We haven't sounded it out since we were
six. And I wonder
six,
how many words the typical American actually memorizes rather than sounds out.
Right.
Probably above 2,000.
And the language, considering the lack of enforced rules in,
right.
In English
better
language.
Have all the memorization.
Yeah, English is not learned. It is memorized.
There's this, some great tricks you can do with, you know, taking a word that's relatively long and just using the first three letters and the last three letters and then making sure the up and down strokes are the same, and you can read it just as fine, you know, just as easily as something that's the correct word.
Hmm. Right, because,
oh, yeah, I've seen
because
that,
they're
yeah,
doing the pattern fun recognition, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, that's cool. All right, well, let's do one more story before we have Mark on. And I think, Al, it's your turn, sir.
Oh.
So go ahead and tell me about some robots. Come on.
Oh, yeah, here's a little few robot. Well, again, out of Japan, a robot has wed a couple, which is a little bit weird.
It performed the ceremony?
It performed the ceremony. It was the name of the robot is Eye Fairy. It's a 4-foot tall robot, and it just sits there, and its eyes flash, and it moves back and forth, and it's got a little bit of movement.
Does it have wings?
No, but it's got probably got big eyes. Given
yeah,
the,
but a fairy, come on, fairy stuff.
Well, they call it that, but it doesn't look like a fairy. And it's built by a subsidiary of the Sanrio company, which owns the rights to, of course, Hello Kitty.
Mm-hmm.
So you can buy these robots. They're pretty expensive. And a couple has been married by one of these things. Mostly it's a robot, you have pre-programmed sounds and stuff
right,
like that. It's just another weird, goofy, like, we were married by a robot.
Sure.
I mean, you know.
Yeah, but was it able to, you know, dance at the ceremony at the end or anything?
I'm sure that its lights flashed or something. I don't know if you really want to do that.
What you need is a robot that's really functional at a wedding. It needs to be able to dance and laugh and cry and drink champagne.
It's funny you'd say that, because there's another one that it's this group has developed. It's his name. Well, it's a guy. His name is Ji Yong Yim, a PhD student in interactive arts and technology, and his supervisor Chris Shaw have collaborated to create Callo and Callie. They're basically cell phone robots, and you clip your cell phone into them. And when you get things, when the call, the thing will dance when it rings, or it'll light up, or if you get text messages, it'll give you certain emotions. It'll wave its arms saying, "Hey, there's a thing here," and all that kind of stuff. And I got to say, after watching the video demonstrating this dumb idea, I was actually impressed because it actually is kind of cute. You know, I mean, when I explain it, you're like, what the heck? Who would want something kind of neat? You know, you put your phone in there and it's just, and it waves, "Hey, you got a text message," you know, and it spins around, and the cell phone robots can also interact. So it's kind of cool. Kind of interesting thing. Not a huge advancement in human technology, but at least, you know, it's nice to see people doing fun stuff with robots,
right,
too.
All right. Well, thank you very much for that story.
Mm-hmm.
So, you're listening to Geek Speak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Al Luckow and Miles Elam. In just a second, we're going to have Mark Farenfelder. See, I told you I'd mess it up during the show. On talk about his book. But first, does anyone have a geek bit in the middle of the show? Geek bit? Al?
My geek pick was the Star Trek thing.
Good, we're done. Let's get Mark on then. Mark, welcome to Geek Speak.
Thanks a lot, Lyle.
So this is actually your second time on Geek Speak, and you were on in June of 2006, I believe, talking about Make Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And because this book relates really well to Make Magazine, why don't you go ahead and give me a brief description of what Make is to most people that haven't heard.
Okay, yeah, sure. Well, Make Magazine is basically a technology project magazine, and the heavy emphasis is on cool do-it-yourself projects, robots, rockets, photography hacks, basically, looking at the world as the ultimate hackable platform. and making cool things. And it can be high tech or low tech.
And when we say hacking, we kind of mean like not using a rule book, not using instructions, not using somebody else's design, not taking a lot of time to design, but kind of grabbing some things and go, you know, I could make something with this, and ripping it apart with a Sawzall or whatever it takes to start making things. So it's a creativity endeavor, and people, amazing makers, do-it-yourself makers that are spending time documenting their work and then sharing the magazine. And I got to say, I'm still in love with Make. I've been in love with the magazine since day one, and I'm still, every time I see it, I'm in love with it. But this book is that you have made by hand, Search for Meaning in Throwaway World, is kind of your exploration of changing the way you are, in some sense, to be more like these impressive, amazing people. Why was it motivated by meeting these people, or were you motivated prior to?
Yeah, well, a big part of it was actually being motivated by the people in the magazine. When I started editing Make Magazine, I really wasn't that much of a do-it-yourselfer in the traditional sense of the word. You know, I was involved in do-it-yourself media, having started blogs and zines and, you know, silkscreen T-shirts and things like that. But actually hacking stuff was something that I had kind of given up a long time ago. You know, because I had failed so many times. But I started hanging out with all these great makers who contributed to the magazine, and I learned that they had kind of gotten over their fear of failure and just accepted the fact that failure is part of the process of being a you know, creative experimenter.
Let's talk about that in a second. I want to back up for just a second, just kind of say that the difference between, I mean, Boing Boing started as a magazine that you and your wife started, right? And it was a traditional magazine in the zine format, and then there's not a large publisher, and it got really successful. Was it, you had 10,000 subscribers or so at some point?
Yeah,
that's
right.
And it was really quite a successful magazine, and you made that completely. I mean, I'm assuming that you went down, you found, at first you probably were Xeroxing them and mailing them out, and at some point you probably found a distributor. But that in itself is a very creative process and very much a do-it-yourself thing. So why do you classify that differently than this kind of do-it-yourself revolution that we're talking about?
Let's see. Well, because I think, you know, with Boing Boing and the other kinds of things that I worked on, I had access to the undo key. And, you know, in the real world, there is no undo key. You know, it's interesting because I also paint. And sometimes when I, you know, mess up a brush stroke or something, I think, oh, you know, I can just reverse that step. But, you know, you can't.
Really, no. Do you use oil or watercolor?
Acrylic.
Well, you can kind of reverse it in acrylic.
Yeah.
You can't do that in watercolor. That's for sure.
It's weird how you think about that, though. You in life, you're doing physical things, and you always think, oh, I'll undo that. I was doing something on my computer yesterday, and I had opened it up because some wires burned, and I'd taken them all out, and I thought, oh, I forgot how those went. I should undo it to see how it looked. And then I realized I can't.
Your hand kind of flitches. When some mistake happens, your hand flitches the control Z, right?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
I was working on a computer. How come there's no control?
That's what happened. The tree hit me. Oh,
no kidding.
So, okay, so you can't classify it differently. The other thing that I was thinking is that in a silk screening, it's a very clear steps. Hundreds of people have done it. You know it's successful. There's no unknowns in sense, except that, well, you might have to read the book one more time, right, on how to do a silk screening process, the emulsion process, everything. It's complicated, but you're following along a step that somebody else did. And that's not really the spirit. The spirit of that do-yourself is, no one's really done this, or someone did it, but I'm going to do it a little differently, and I'm going to try to use this old motor that never really worked. So it's kind of a different mentality of, I don't know, I'm going to explore as I go. And that's kind of why we're calling it hacking, that rather than follow along on these steps.
A lot of experimentation, for sure.
Yeah. I want to talk, so the undo process and the idea of jump into the fear, it's a great idea from improvisational theater, that go ahead and say no, say yes to failure, say yes to everything, right? And then when you fail, you will learn. There is a lot to that, especially if you have kids. When you have kids, you kind of know that when they make a mistake on something, they're much more likely to do it because they understand what they want to be doing, rather than because they were told what to do. So that exploration of failure is a really important step in learning.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you see that with kids all the time. I have fairly young kids, and if they see me using a tool that they had never seen before, the first thing they ask is, "Oh, can I try it?" Kids are natural experimenters, and when I was doing all these things that I wrote about in my book, like building a chicken coop and raising chickens and becoming a beekeeper and harvesting honey, retrofitting my espresso machine, making cigar box guitars. My kids were really curious about it and wanted to, see what I was doing and help me in any way that they could. It was really a fun way to kind of connect with my kids.
You started the book talking about kind of a big failure in like a life decision that was kind of lead into this. Can you tell us about going to South Pacific with your wife and kids?
Yeah. Carla and I, my wife and I, this was in 2003, January 2003. We were just, you know, the dot-com implosion had been in effect for a while, and as freelance journalists for technology magazines, our work was kind of dwindling along with the crash. Mm-hmm. And so we thought, you know, this might be a good time for a change. And we, you know, looked at our lives. They were pretty stressed out and hectic living here in Los Angeles. And we thought it might be interesting to go somewhere where there's a simpler way of life, something that we can kind of have more control over. So we sold our house and sold everything and packed up and moved to a little island in the South Pacific called Rarotonga.
Wow.
Which is, it's in the South Pacific, and it's about, you know, like 5 miles long and 5 miles wide. Wow. It's a tiny speck, and there's nothing near it. I think Tahiti might be 3.5 hours away. That would be the closest thing of any size. And then New Zealand's maybe 5 or 6 hours by plane. Mm-hmm. And so we moved there and started to, try to live this simpler life. But of course,
it's not that simple.
It's not that simple. No, and there are a lot of things that we learned. First of all, the medical care was a problem, especially when, you know, you have a kid who's 2.5 months old and she gets pneumonia.
Yeah.
And,
how many people were on the island? I mean,
there's quite a few, actually. There's like 9,000 people on the island.
Huh. It's a pretty developed place, yeah.
Yeah, so we ended up with getting like pneumonia and lice and ringworm and really bad toenail fungus and
but it was simple.
Yeah, it was simple lice and simple toenail fungus.
But you also learned how to harvest coconuts and use it for baking, and the kids helped with that. I mean, there was a wonderful part of it about it too.
Yeah, and so what we realized was, you know, this kind of slow living pattern that we got into where, you know, we had coconut trees on the property of the little house that we rented there. And, we finally learned how to get the equipment to extract the coconut stuff. It's like a coconut scraping bench that we learned how to crack open the coconuts. And my daughter, who was 5 at the time, loved helping with coconuts. And we basically had a thing called Coconut Day that we did a couple of times a week where we would harvest the coconuts and extract the coconut water and the coconut meat, and we would make pancakes and scones, and then we started, you know, just making everything. We couldn't get tortillas there, so we made our own tortillas out of flour. We made our own pasta, and it was really like the best part of it was just like really focusing and slowing down and being mindful of that kind of thing. And so when we got back to LA, I said, you know, that's the best part of our trip, and it's something that we can replicate here. Mm-hmm. In Los Angeles, wherever we live, we can like start taking more of an active role in the creation and maintenance of everything around us.
And this isn't about spending less money there's a lot of, when people go to the Maker Fair and they see somebody's really cool robot that's able to walk around the room or do something amazing or even read Make Magazine, a lot of people will go, ooh, well, if you do this, you could sell it. And that's not the mentality about all of this. It's about a lifestyle. It's not about selling it. So the coconut experience, of course, in the States, you can just get coconut milk in a can. You don't have to do any of that work, right?
Right.
But that work is actually what the life is.
Yeah, exactly. It's having more control over what you do that really makes a difference. You know, by making your own stuff, not only are you more kind of observant and aware of those things and those processes, but you also start becoming more aware of everything else too. You know, like I make these cigar box guitars and I whittle my own spoons. Mm-hmm. Out of wood. And now I actually, you know, I really study the way that wood, that other, you know, other people's projects, how the wood is fastened, how guitars are made. I study the frets and guitars and things like that. So it opens your eyes up to kind of the manufactured world, and you feel like you're kind of part of it instead of just this passive consumer who has no say in what they, you know, buy and use. You have more of a choice and more control over it, and it's a really rewarding feeling to be more engaged like that.
You're listening to geekspeak.org. All the stuff we talk about is up on our website. Geekspeak.org, the show is Geekspeak. My name is Lyle Troxell. In the air with me is Al Lockhall, Miles Elam. We're speaking with Mark Frauenfelder. He is the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine. He is the founder of BoingBoing.net, the world's most popular blog. And his new book is called Made by Hand, Search for Meaning in a Throwaway World. You touched right there on consumerism versus creativity. Can you tell me a little bit about who Edward Bernays is?
Oh, sure. Edward Bernays was the nephew of Sigmund Freud, and he is also kind of the father of modern propaganda. He was the guy who, in World War I, coined the term "Make America safe" or "Make the world safe for democracy."
And when you say modern propaganda, that's the more nefarious way of saying marketing.
Yeah, exactly, exactly, and. After his success in kind of selling World War I to a really like reluctant American public who didn't who would rather have been more isolationist, he realized that there were certain techniques that he could use based on his uncle's work on the subconscious to get people to really buy almost anything, and so. He worked for the American Tobacco Company to come up with a campaign to get women to smoke more cigarettes because women weren't really smoking nearly as much as men. So he figured a way to tie smoking into the women's suffrage movement and presented cigarettes.
Empower women to smoke in public and things.
Right. Yeah. And, defined cigarettes as torches of freedom. And so he equated, freedom with becoming addicted to cigarettes. And so he did that with a lot of things. And basically, his advertising campaigns changed the way that advertising worked. Instead of ads that kind of showed you the features of things and showed you why, a product could improve your life and in practice.
Appealing to your intellect, basically. The old style of appealing to your intellect. Sure.
Yes. He appealed to your subconscious urges, appealing to your id, and made it so that things like made homemade things seem shameful.
Right.
Like homemade clothing was you would not be attractive or appealing if you wore homemade clothes, or your car needed to be new. You always needed a new car. You shouldn't try to have repair a car.
Mm-hmm.
So all those kinds of things, and so he kind of. Helped change our country from a nation of do-it-yourselfers into a nation of consumers who were, trying to satisfy really an insatiable, our insatiable unconscious desires by hooking these products up to, sex and power and things like that.
His example is everywhere. It's not just, it's not just sex in some ways. It's also like if you see a lawn, talk about how well it's repairable, how long the blade lasts. It does all these things that are actually interesting to a lawnmower, like where do you get repaired, how long does it take, how much gas does it use, all these things that are quite important. Instead, it just takes and shows you a 10-year-old pushing a lawnmower easily and the sun shining, right? So you get this feeling of, wow, if I get this lawnmower, then my kids will be healthy and outside. It's just totally devoid of what the actual product is. It's much more the experience of the product. And it's everywhere, of course.
Or sometimes they give you the exact opposite. Like you'll go to a store and they'll say, save money by buying this. Well, the bottom line is if you're spending money, you're not saving anything.
Right.
And they're telling you the exact opposite of what you're doing. And you're believing it. Oh, I got to get that so I can save money.
Right. Yeah.
No, don't buy it and you'll save money. If you buy it, you're losing money. And it's the exact opposite. And we've, been programmed to believe all that stuff.
And buy these sugar crack puffs. Part of this complete breakfast.
Yeah, exactly.
And what you're saying is that you see a time before this marketing happened that was everybody could fix their own vehicle kind of thing, and now a time that's post that. And I just wanted to catch you on one thing that, to be able to repair things like a vehicle and stuff, the complexity and the engineering that's currently there, you've got to have a lot of tools for a lot of these things, right? When you start, like in the Make magazine, you have a great section on tools, right? I remember, I think your first issue had a screwdriver set that could open anything, you know, because a lot of times the screws are designed to not be opened because the manufacturer doesn't really want you playing in that because it gets them to be more dangerous with lawsuits if you hurt yourself, you know, lots of reasons of that sort that are corporate-based, not use-based. And that whole idea, the thing is, at this point, how do you really do it? Because if I wanted to fix my own car and make sure it kept running, I've got to have computer diagnostic systems, and it gets really quite complicated.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, that's why for car enthusiasts, a lot of them want cars that were built, you know, in the 60s when you could actually get in there and have some elbow room to access the things you want to access.
Yeah.
I think it was Matthew Crawford in Shopcraft of Soulcraft who pointed out that, like, today's cars, when you open the hood, there's another hood there, you know, like,
right.
you can't get to it. And the tools to fix cars are, you can't even buy them if you want to buy them because they're only available to licensed dealers.
Yeah.
You know, they're highly specialized. And so things are very maker unfriendly now, products.
And really, because the cheaper you can make the vehicle is the most important thing. You know, a consumer's not really looking at the overall lifespan of the item necessarily, or have them doing it themselves.
That's true. They're not, you know, most people aren't interested in understanding how their things work, and they just, you know, want to buy them, and when they stop working, they want to just dispose of them and buy another one because it's not that expensive. Like, you know, like a color TV in the 50s cost about $8,000 in today's money, you know, adjusted for inflation. And so when it broke, you couldn't throw it away and buy another one. It was, you just couldn't do that. So what you would do, and the manufacturer knew that, you would open up the perforated board on the back of the TV, there'd be a schematic on it. Mm-hmm. You could just pop the tubes out, drive down to the local drugstore, and there would be a machine sitting in the corner that you just walk up to and you stick the tubes into, and a little needle on a meter would show you if the tube was bad or good, and you could open up the cabinet, pick the tube you needed, and go home and replace it.
That actually extended. I mean, I grew up in the 70s, and I had to do that with our TV.
Yeah,
I remember
sure.
just to the point where, you know, you put the back of the TV on, but you only put like one screw in there because you have to keep taking it off. So it just take the one off and pop it out.
Right.
Yeah. It's amazing. And so now, you know, everything, you know, has a no user serviceable parts inside right. sticker on it, and you can't even open it anyway because it's glued together. And you know, most people don't care because a color TV costs, you know, a fraction mm-hmm. of what it does, or what it did back then.
Or so rather, $8,000 gets you a really, really good TV.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, apart from the throwing away and you know, the problems associated with toxic materials, you know, it's kind of nice that nice things are more affordable and replaceable. But I think you also lose something in always just being able to buy solutions
right.
to every one of your problems. And so, you know, that's what one reason make it, I think, is so popular, is because it gives people a chance to make things and fix things and modify things for their own needs. And it fulfills a kind of an ancient need that people have had. We're born with opposable thumbs. We are tool making. We've been tool making animals for longer than we've been human beings.
Right.
And to be able to do that, I think, is just something that's really important. It was probably, you know, from natural selection, those individuals and tribes that enjoyed experimenting and making things, they had a better chance of survival. So we sure. passed down that kind of maker gene.
Some say that it's actually part of a genetics, that if you said that if you took a human being and removed all technology and all tool ability, you wouldn't really have the same species. Just the removing of that, you know?
Yeah, I would not argue that. I think that's true. And so, you know, in today, in the developed Western world, making things yourself is not cheaper; it's more expensive.
Yeah.
But it's very fulfilling, and it's relatively inexpensive compared to a lot of other kinds of activities. You know, like vacation to Europe, or buying a powerboat, or an RV, right. or something like that.
And, you know, your book, just to be clear for everybody that don't have it in front of them, your book really is a step by step of you doing these projects and how it really works. You know, how do you kill your lawn and grow garden? Because, of course, a lawn you've got to remove. Like, the whole step process. The chicken coop building, I recently went through the same thing. And we're taking care of chickens now, and it's a completely different experience with our food. Our entire life cycle is different at the house because our scraps now go to the chickens, and then the chickens produce eggs, and then those come back in. And, you know, you're much more connected. And, of course, the kids, the experience of that. And I'm just surprised not that everyone doesn't have chickens if they've got a few feet outside. You know, it's not that hard, and the benefits are amazing. They're not financial benefits. You know, we pay more for our eggs, probably. We haven't really gotten to the full cycle, but we probably will, you know. And it's not about that. It's this quality of life. But one I want to ask you about is espresso machines, because I got to love coffee. Why do you hack an espresso machine? What's the point of it? I mean, I have a pretty good espresso machine at home that I purchased a while ago, and I looked at, you know, buying espresso at a store versus making it home, and went, well, making it home makes a lot of sense within a year if you buy a, you know, $200 or $300 machine. What's wrong with those machines? Why hack it?
Well, yeah, that's a really good question. So I, you know, espresso is a 2 or 3 times a day part of my life. So, you know, it has been for the last 15 or 20 years. So.
That's why Boing Boing's so successful.
That's why it's called Boing Boing.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought, you know, that is an area where I really want to get as good at making something as possible, because I'll get a lot of bang for the buck. And so I, you know, have an espresso machine that costs $500 called the Rancilio Silvia espresso machine. And it is kind of like a 1950s car. It's very easy to open. There's a lot of room in there to modify, and easy to access all the components and stuff. It's actually the most documented espresso machine in the world, because espresso machine hackers love it, and there's, you know, PDFs of the schematics and you know, all sorts of descriptions. And so
I wanted to touch base on that. We talked about technology being so complex it's really hard to do things, but the thing is, we also have the internet with people figuring it out, really complicated people figuring, and then them saying, by the way, it's the fourth pin that you need to tie to ground to make the circuit work if you want to add this camera. So, like, a lot of people are helping with the complexity. So you're saying there's schematics on how to hack the heck out of this thing, which is cool.
And so it turns out that the one weak point of the Silvia machine is that, and like any espresso machine that's under, you know, $1,000, is that the thermostat that controls the water temperature is just a bimetallic thermostat that clicks on and off. And so when it reaches its set point temperature, the thermostat shuts off, but the heater element is still really hot, and so the temperature continues to climb up for a while, and then it goes down, and then the thermostat clicks in the other direction, the circuit's connected, and the heater starts up, but the heating element's cold, so the water temperature is dropping. So you can get up to a 40-degree temperature swing in the water temperature when the indicator lamp is off, saying that it's time to pull a shot. And a 40-degree temperature swing can make the coffee completely unpredictable on how it's going to taste. That's like way too much.
This is a big reason why when you start your espresso machine and make an espresso, if you do it a certain way every day and then you try to make a second espresso, there's no way you'll get it right. You'll get a consistency if you do it the same every time. If you, you know, as soon as the light goes off, then you make your coffee. It'll be the same as the next day you do it. But during the espresso shots, it's not the same. And of course, if you're getting your toast, when the light turns off, you're going to get a totally different temperature. So how do you hack that? How do you fix that?
So the way to do it is to get a temperature controlling device called a proportional integral derivative temperature control system.
Of course.
And it's basically, nice and simple. It's used to control, you know, industrial processes where temperature is really important. And so what you do is you replace the bimetallic thermostat with a thermocouple. And then that thermocouple goes to the little computer inside the PID box, which then shuts a relay off and on the relay controls the heating element, turns the heating element off and on. And so as the heating element is on and the temperature is rising and the water is getting warmer, the PID computer is saying, wow, the temperature is rising really fast. I'm going to start cycling the heating element off, on, off, on, so that we just approach the temperature and then we hit that desired temperature of like 198 degrees for the water, and then it stabilizes it, and the temperature only varies like 1 degree or less. And so you've locked down one of the important variables in making espresso. And so as long as you have, you know, high quality coffee, the freshness, the consistency of the grind, all those other things, you're going to get more, you know, predictably and reliably good espresso. And so it turned out
it worked well?
Yeah, okay. It's wonderful.
Do you also modify the light so the light actually turns off when it's the right temperature? Or?
I have is a LED readout that
cool.
tells
shows
you the exact temperature.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah,
you
that's
know,
great.
I had a question for Mark real quick. The things you're talking about, very inspiring in that. And I was just curious what your life is like. What's your day like now? I mean, given all this, these things, these great things you've done and this philosophy, it's just fantastic. And I'm just curious right now, you know, I mean, you're not cracking coconuts in your front lawn. You get up in the morning. What do you do? I mean, what's an average day for you?
I work on Make Magazine and Boing Boing
from home.
And, from home.
So you
I
work
do
from
everything.
Home.
Yeah, I work from home. And, part of the book was, I wanted to kind of incorporate DIY into my life in a way that kind of makes sense and do it in a reasonable way and not an extreme way that would be just kind of a gimmick or something.
Mm-hmm.
So, my DIY activities are probably, you know, on average days limited to, you know, an hour or less a day. On weekends I might spend more, but you know, it could be tending to my garden that I have, you know, I have a bunch of self watering garden containers, checking on my bees. I love when I have a conference call or something, I love to sit out in the backyard and just work on whittling spoons. It's
so
kind of like knitting.
His life is basically exactly like yours, except he's doing a little bit more.
I do the same kind of thing. Yeah, it's been my goal to get that point, and it's inspiring. I think people should be inspired by that kind
I agree.
Goal.
The book is Made by Hand, Searching for Meaning in a Throwaway World. It's Mark Farnfelder. He is the editor-in-chief of Make Magazine, which is awesome. And your wife does Craft Magazine, correct?
Craft Magazine is no longer a print publication.
Oh,
it's online
isn't.
Only.
You know, I didn't subscribe to it, so I didn't know.
So
what a really wonderful magazine as well. And I'm sure that a lot of the website has most of the content on it.
Yeah, craftscene.com is still up. And so there's great stuff on there, you know, new content all the time.
So take a look at his book. And Mark, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Lyle. All I appreciate
right.
it.
I'll talk to you soon, I'm sure.
Okay.
Take care.
Take care.
Thanks.
Bye.
Bye-bye. In just a second, the USB of the week. This is Central Coast Public Radio, KOSP Santa Cruz. We're streaming and podcasting at kosp.org.
Hello, everybody. This is Al Luckow with Geek Speak's crazy USB device of the week. Well, we're all planting gardens now, it seems. It's a fun hobby and really not all that hard. Put a seed in the ground, water it, and it grows. If you keep watering it, eventually you'll have something like tomatoes or zucchini. Depends on the seed you planted. If you can't wait that long, you can buy plants that are already growing called starts. You stick those in the ground, water them, and they grow. Well, if this just seems too easy for you, I've got a device sure to complicate your gardening adventure. It's called the Easy Bloom Plant Sensor. It's a little USB stick that has what looks to be a flower on top. You stick it in the dirt, you leave it there a while, and it'll be able to tell you if the dirt's moist, and it can also tell you if it's sunny, after you've plugged it into your computer, that is. You know, you're not going to believe this, but I have the amazing natural ability to tell these two things with my own eyes. But that's just me, and I'm gifted. Try not to be jealous. It also claims to have some sort of fertilizer sensor, but that's only available with a subscription. Anyway, Easy Bloom is sure to complicate your gardening with bugs of a different kind. It's a real thing. Check it out on geekspeak.org.